Okay, I'm Joe Felsenstein. This is Genome 570, so all of you who have come here for some other course can now proceed and find your room you're supposed to be in. I think we have about 18 registered students and some people who aren't students who are sitting in. And we're going to be going Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays at this hour. There will be a final exam. There's no midterm, which will be the week. It'll be the exam week, and it will be on the Wednesday of exam week. It'll be in the time slot that is the according to the university's system of class, a particular hour have an exam at a particular time. Our final exam is 2:30 to 4:30. 4:30 plus, I let people go on, in the Wednesday of exam week, which is the 16th of March. And I have verified that we have this room available for that. There is a website for the course. There's also a mailing list for the course. On the website for the course, the mailing list is mentioned. Here's the course website. And let's see, up here it's talking about that. It's a little hard to see, but the according to the university system for doing these things, which I need a darker pen for. It's Genome 570, little A, underscore, winter, WI, 16, the year, and that's at, I think, U Washington Edu, which is also equivalent to UW Edu, unless I'm mistaken about that. And basically, anyone registered for the course can be, will be on that mailing list. When I email out to you, I will email to that course name, to that course email list, and it will go out, but it would only get to the registered students. If you're not registered and you're sitting in, which is something, by the way, that I don't allow potentially registrable students to do, but I do allow like postdocs and technicians to do, you should email me and ask me to put you on that mailing list. I'm not completely sure whether I have control of it in the administrative sense, but I'll try to do that. That way everybody will get the email announcements. I'll try to put news on the website as well. And the main news are things like homeworks being assigned and stuff like that. But the other possible use of the course mailing list is if you have a question. Now, you can email me a question, said, I heard what you said in lecture this morning, but I don't understand point XYZ. What I like to do, unless your question is very personal to you, is take your question, edit away your identity, and give my answer to the email mailing list so that everybody sees it. Because if you have a question, probably a bunch of other people have an equivalent question. So unless if it's a question concerning you personally and, you know, you're coming to the course or whatever, I can't be there Wednesday, blah, 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 sir, because I have a dentist appointment, I'm not going to broadcast that to the whole class that you have a dentist appointment, even anonymized, partly because nobody would be interested. But general questions can be there, and you can answer questions. If people, say, well, what about XYZ? And if I don't get back to it in time, or even if I do and that doesn't completely explain it, you're encouraged to say, well, I thought that such and such, what about that? And, you know, there could be some discussion there. Let's see, some other things. We will be We'll have homeworks. There are going to be four homeworks. Basically, what they are is to let you try to analyze data under four major classes of phylogeny methods. My general system is to assign them, I like to assign if I can on a Wednesday. And so the first one will be a week from this Wednesday, and give you a week, and then you email me the answers. And basically what it's going to be is asking you to analyze using parsimony methods, likelihood methods, distance matrix methods, likelihood methods, and Bayesian methods, some data set. It could be one that you have that you're particularly interested in, but there also are some ones that I provide on the website, or you can go off into the literature and get yourself a data set. Let's see if I can find where this all is. Yeah, here I put together some, well, there is a section of the website, I know you can't read from where you are, that shows you some particular data sets. Some of them are too small, really, for the homework. I don't want you to do one of 10 species. It should have 20, 30, 40 species. I give some small data sets here, some larger ones, and then I went to an interesting website called OrthoMam, and OrthoMam is mammalian fully sequenced species, all of their alignable genes, basically. So, or as many as they could get. I think it was in the vicinity of 15,000 loci. And what they did, the people in France who put this together, is make alignments for a whole bunch of genes in the human genome for over 40 different mammalian species. I should say that mammalian phylogenies are a little bit difficult. So if I take one of them, like GGH, it's a text file. You can download it mostly by bringing it up in a browser and using the file menu and the save command, or save as command, because it's a text file. And basically what these things are, they're in the format for my file programs, but there are ways to get it into all sorts of other programs, rather easy ways. So this one has like 40 species and 957 sites. These are DNA sites. And so you have these loci. So I have a whole bunch of loci. I have about 40 of them, I think. Let me just see. Okay. Yeah, anyway, you'll see. That's the number of loci I have. And if you want to know what species these things are, there's a file called species that tells you. See if I can. Yeah. It tells you the shorthand names that we're using here, what these things are. It'll give you some feel for those. So those are a bunch of data sets that you could also use. So you can use one of your own. You can find something in literature. You can use one of these. And I'll be going into a little more detail what I want you to do in your reports that you turn in. The reports are turned in as PDF, or you can turn them in as Word documents if you're careful. I usually lately have been able to read Word documents, but that didn't always used to be true. PDFs I can usually read. And you will turn it in a week after. Okay, that's for homeworks. The textbook, I should mention. Now, I was going to say the greedy thing, by using my own book as a textbook. Now, the book is called Inferring Phylogenies. It's copyright 2003, and it's actually copyright 2004, but it appeared in 2003. So it's 12 years old, but it's still pretty current. It's a bit of a massive book with all kinds of methods described in it. It's more than you need. I hasten to say that although on new copies of any kind that you buy, I do make a royalty. the university has a policy that, which I will bring in force at the end of the course, that I must pay them back the cost of the royalties. I must pay it as a, I must make a good faith estimate of how much royalty money I've made from the course, and pay that as a donation to the university. And so I actually won't make any money from your buying the book. We're going to go through the book almost in order, but we're going to have to start skipping stuff the further we get in, because it's more than a single course. So that means the course is kind of a slog through a lot of methods, explaining why they work and how they work, and explaining some things other than just how you estimate a phylogeny, explaining some things you can do with phylogenies, what the logic of them is. It's, I suspect, more than most people need, but all I can say is you're dealing with me, so that's what you get. It's too much detail. So, another thing I should mention is to urge you to ask questions. I do this all the time in my courses now. It doesn't entirely work, because in the evaluations for the course, when people list what aspects of the course were done well and what weren't done so well, one of the things that loses out is I felt I could ask questions. And so I usually have taken lately to beg people to please ask questions, because if you have a question and you think it's stupid, don't think it's stupid, because that almost certainly means other people have the same question, and they'll be very grateful to you if you can ask them. And if that becomes too disruptive, I'll let you know. But I'm trying to allow lots of interaction, lots of questions. If, on the other hand, you're one of these people who likes to show off their knowledge in the field, which is fine, you should be ready to explain what you say to your fellow students. So if you raise your hand and say, what about the work of so-and-so who, you know, did blah, 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 and blah, 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 what's your assessment of that? And you use all kinds of terms that we haven't explained yet in the course, I will slow you down and say, could you go back to the beginning? Could you explain what you, to the class who does not yet know what that term means, what you just said? And I also urge you, people, there's sometimes an effect that people sitting close to me ask in very faint voices, because they're trying to be polite, they're trying to be timid. So I'd just like to ask you a question about, you know, and the people in the back literally can't hear what question they're asking. I'll try to repeat questions if I think that's happened. I want to say that years ago when I was teaching, I was population genetics course, there were two guys who used to drive me crazy doing this. One would always sit at the front, another at the back. They seemed to trade off. And each one would raise his hand and ask very faint, technically complicated questions. They were both very good, but they weren't very considerate of other people in the class. So I finally, when one of them, could I just ask the question, I just blew up, and I said, he said, could you tell me blah, blah, blah? And I said, no, I'm not going to tell you. What really happened? One of them did that. Could you just tell me blah, blah, blah? And the other one at the back, the other guy who did the same thing, usually, raised his hand and said, could you tell me what he just said? And I looked at him and I said, no, because you do the same thing. And there was a big grins in the class, because everyone had been suffering through these guys' questions. So ask them loud enough, please. And I'm slightly hard of hearing, so even louder. Okay. We're going to be recording the lectures. That has two effects. One is, and I will upload them to the website, to an area on the website. There's a place, let's see. Let me see, this mouse is a little too reactive here. There's a spot, lecture projections and audio recordings. There's this table. We'll be filling in this table with the recordings in two formats, WMA and MP3. MP3 is the one that everybody knows about. WMA is the format in which they're actually recorded. So I put them both up here. So if you miss a lecture and you want to know what I said, you can go there. I try to put them up the same day. I also put up the PDFs of the lecture projections. They're not PowerPoints, they're PDFs. And the ones I have up there are from the previous time I gave the course, 2014, 2 years ago. And they're labeled old, but as we go on, those old labels will disappear. The ones we'll use are very similar, but I'm going to add a little bit of material to each one. So if you want to look ahead, you more or less get an idea from those, but it won't be perfect. So we'll have the other effect, though, that you have to have is when I come in and I'm setting up for the lecture and everybody's talking, and I push the button for record, any nasty remarks you're making about friends of yours will be recorded and available to the public on the website. So you might want to, the moment you see me go to push the button, you might want to think about what you're saying, because if after that it's going to be on the website. We'll be working our way through a whole bunch of issues regarding different methods. There will be an interlude in the middle. There is a syllabus on the website that is, let's see, there's a link for a syllabus. Yeah, there's a syllabus of lectures. And they link to particular chapters that we're reading in. So we're going to be working our way through these. We will not be spending a lot of time talking about empirical data, what people have actually found looking at phylogenies. It would be desirable, but it would change the course away from talking about the methods. Sometimes those empirical discussions have no real, they don't really do anything for you, except if you're an empiricist, make you feel comfortable with the material and that it's not so abstract. Sometimes they give you a chance to look at nice pictures of cute fuzzy animals and so on, which is fine, but I'm not sure what role it would play. You're going to see a lot of examples that I use that are just rather abstract. Okay, so are there questions about course mechanics or course content that anybody has? This would be a very good moment to say, well, are you going to cover this or are you going to cover that? Yeah, please.
Are you going to
have the honor of asking the first question of what I hope will be many. Yeah.
Nick Donald Crichton test?
Actually, no. I do not cover that. It's an interesting area. That, for the people who don't know what it is, the McDonnell-Kreitman test is, let's see, I have to distinguish between the HKA test, which is Hudson-Kreitman-Agwade. McDonnell-Kreitman is a version of testing whether there is selection at a locus because there's excessive, there is more non-synonymous substitution than synonymous. I will actually mention that and cover that in its sort of likelihood form at some point here. Let's see, where is it? It's when we talk about likelihood methods. Yeah, there is a day on the 8th of February, protein models and distances and likelihood methods. There is at least a brief coverage of that, but it's pretty brief. But so if you're interested in the synonymous, non-synonymous stuff, there is some coverage in the book, not a huge amount, and I will go over that. Yeah.
Is there any programming, or is this more running software that already exists?
This is running software that already exists. I will not require it. And if you want to go do programming, write your own program to do each of these things, more power to you. But I'm not requiring any of that. There will be, you will probably find yourself, depending on whose software you want to use, you may be finding yourself having to convert data files from one format to another. There are web-based tools out there for doing that, and there are programs for doing that, so that may get you a little bit tangled into that. But in general, I will not ask anybody to program anything. So, and I should say that the math we use is fairly elementary. It's high school algebra, elementary calculus, simple probability and statistics calculations. When it goes beyond that, I will be giving you lots of warnings. And a lot of what we do doesn't even involve much math. I mean, it can be made to sound very mathy, but it's more it's more intuitive than that. You'll see that coming fairly soon. More questions on materials or questions on the mechanics of the course. Okay, yeah, again, please.
What about when we talk about how population genetics or structures impact how you interpret phylogenies?
There will be a little bit of that, and it will mostly be in way down late in the course when I get to talking about how you do almost at the end. I talk about see if I can trees from Brownian motion processes, which are modeling gene frequency change. So there's a little bit of population genetics in there. I actually don't talk about population structure. That we don't have space for that. And also, I'm going to talk about continuous characters, measurable characters, like sort of how long my forearm is, for example. And making, but mostly using trees to interpret that data. And that connects directly with quantitative genetics of multifactorial traits and polygenic traits in populations. And while I won't go into much of that theory, I'll at least be trying to show that there is a connection between quantitative genetics and the machinery that you use to try to interpret continuous characters. So that's as close. That's where we make contact with those. Yeah. Now the people in the back have to hear you. Yeah.
I'm a loud person. It's okay.
Okay.
If you have a large enough data set, do all the homeworks have the potential for you to use your own? And would there be any homeworks that it would be detrimental to use your own and you'd prefer us to use one, or you could?
The only reason not to use your own would be if it were too small a data set. If you had your own data and you're terribly fascinated by it, but it's only 6 species, then I might say, well, could you? But it actually, for asking you to take a data set, analyze it, and then report on the following things, if you want to include in the report analyzing also your own data set, if it's, say, too small, that would be fine. You'd have to do at least some analysis that uses a big enough data set. That's really the only issue. Or if your data set was not the right kind of data, in the sense that if you had discrete characters morphological data and I were trying to get you to run something that basically needs sequence data, then that wouldn't quite work. So, but other than that, generally people are, you know, you're entirely, it's entirely a good thing to use your own data set. Yeah.
As far as the right kind of data for our own data sets, you mentioned the number of species that are in them. If our own data set is many strains of a single species, is that going to work?
It is going to work. There are issues that I won't talk a lot about. I should mention the other place where population genetics comes in a lot is in these two lectures here, which are about coalescence, which is about trees of ancestry of single gene copies at a single locus within a species. When you're working with strains within a species, there are issues like recombination and issues about like migration among populations that really do complicate things and often make can make phylogeny methods inappropriate. So one has to sort of watch out for that. I mean, you could do the analysis anyway and report it to me and then say, well, however, this might not be the right thing to do for this data. That's okay. It was popular for a while, I hope it's fading away, for people to do within species what were called individual-based phylogenies. And that was, you take data from different individuals, say, you know, some sequence from each of us, and you make a phylogeny. And it drives me crazy. Every time I encounter this in discussions on the internet, I come in and I say, that's wrong, you shouldn't do it. And the reason is because I can reveal now that my own ancestry has the remarkable property that it is not a tree. Okay, the genealogy of me isn't a tree. Why? Because actually, I had both a mother and a father. Now, some of you may also have had both a mother and a father. I mean, you likely had both, even though you may not know who they were. But I mean, you had them. And some of my genes came from each of them. And so when you start tracing out the ancestry in a population, you don't get a tree. The lineages don't just converge going back, they diverge going back. And that will be true for everybody. And people were out there just saying, oh, trees are popular, let's make individual-based phylogenies. And I, you know, if you see the missing hair, a part of it was just me tearing it out. And why are people doing this? Okay. So that's the qualification with using strains. If the strains have an ancestry that is populations that historically branched, and you want to get information on that, then that's a valid reason for doing that.
So would it be valid in a species that reproduces asexually, so where it is more of a...
Yes, it would be pretty valid, yeah. Okay, I want to start in, and where we're starting is in the very first chapter of the book. And what I do there is to give you, I'm going to be talking about a collection of methods called parsimony methods, which are sort of minimum evolution methods. That is, they try to find that tree which evolves your data with the fewest changes of state, where changes of state are counted somehow. These methods were very popular in the 70s and 80s, and they faded some as in general use. But they're a really good place to start because it's very easy to see intuitively what's going on. And you get and in many ways, and in some areas like comparative genomics, parsimony methods are very important because other methods can't readily be done. So I'm going to start out with a long, you know, days and days and days on different aspects of parsimony methods. They also introduce us to the concept of evaluating trees and searching in tree space. And I want to just indicate that when somebody has not read any of the literature in this field and encounters it for the first time, they'll often sit down and say, oh, now how would I make a tree? And usually the way they will come up with, which is the way a lot of people early in the field were, is to say, well, let's take our species and let's find a couple of them that are very similar to each other and put them next to each other on a tree and then keep working from there. They'll think of an algorithm. First you put this one with that one, then you put this one with that one. But it turns out that the best way to think about all of these algorithms is not to do that, not to get down into the nitty-gritty of the details of the algorithm, but to think about the general objective and think about, look, we're looking for trees that have, in this case, the fewest changes of state. How do we count, if someone gives us a tree, how do we count the number of changes of state on that tree? And how do we consider the whole set, the space of possible trees? And if we now know a way for every one of them to count how many changes of state there are, how can we go search in that space? So thinking of a tree space and thinking of a way to evaluate an individual tree, are much clearer ways to think about inferring phylogenies than thinking about the nitty-gritty of first you make a list of six things, and then on alternate Thursdays you connect this one with that one. Those details are not a good way to start. So you'll see all that in action in the parsimony methods as we go over them. Well, I've talked far too long, so let me, let's see. First, go to my projection, if I can find it. There we go. Now, all right. So what we're going to do is I'm going to be showing you a very simple example where you can sort of analyze it intuitively. You can look at it, and you can count the number of changes of state without considering what machinery you would really need to use in a computer to count the changes of state. And the data I'm going to give is just a trivial, not real data set. And it is characters that have two alternative states. We're going to see the same thing done with DNA sequences, where there are four alternative states as we go along. But in this case, the characters are two alternative states. They might be different morphology. They might be presence or absence of a scale, of a ridge on a scale of a lizard, say. Or they might be presence or absence of deletions at particular spots on DNA, something like that. And I think that I'm having a little bit of trouble here. Excuse me for a moment. My laser pointer is, I think the battery is a little low, so we will just quickly, if I remember what order these go in, fix that. There we go. That should be good enough. Or won't work at all. Okay. So we have six characters. That would be equivalent to like six sites in DNA. And a bunch of species. And I should say, the species are called alpha, beta, gamma, delta, epsilon. Sometimes people think I'm talking about hemoglobins. No, they're species. They're just imaginary names of species. And here's the data set. We want to do a parsimony analysis. We want to find that phylogeny that needs the fewest changes of states at a minimum. Among all possible phylogenies, or that set of phylogenies that are tied for minimum. So what I'm going to do is suggest that first thing we need to know is how to evaluate the score for a particular tree. So we're imagining somebody just came along and gave us a tree, not necessarily the best tree. Okay, here's the tree. So it's got alpha next to delta. So, of course, this is a sequence of speciation events. You have a lineage. There was a speciation. There were two descendants. By the way, the leftness and rightness doesn't mean anything. And it's quite possible, actually, to make trees be somewhat misleading to people who examine them. The people who often look up the tip and read from left to right. But, in fact, I could have put either of these lineages in either order. I could flip them around, and the same thing at every fork. Okay. So sequence of speciations, we're saying, well, suppose that that was what happened. How many changes of state would we need? Well, the way to do that is to consider one character at a time, one column of the data matrix at a time. So here's the data again. Here's the first column. I've colored them in. And now we say, well, there's a 1 in alpha, a 1 in gamma, and a 1 in delta, and 0 in beta and epsilon. So you look over here, and you'll say, well, the ones here, these first three are 1s, and those are 0s. What's the smallest number of changes of state that you could have? Well, one way would be a single change of state. You certainly can't go any lower than that, because there are two states, so there must have been at least one change. And we could put it here, and we could say, well, we start out with 0, And zero carries on up those lineages, and there are no changes. And here there's a change from zero to one. They all inherit once. So that's a possible scenario. And that's the smallest number of changes that you need for that character. But you could also do this. You could start out with a one. On this lineage, it changes from one to zero. We're allowing the change in either direction in this case. Those become zeros. The ones carry on up here. So these are two different reconstructions of what happened to get you the minimum number of changes of state. It doesn't mean that that's the way biology actually worked. There could be more. I mean, it could be that instead of a change from zero to one here, this continued zero up to this point, changed to one in this lineage, and changed to one in that lineage. There'd be two parallel changes. That may be what really happened. But this is the minimum, this is the scenario that has the minimum number of changes. It may be smaller than what actually happened. And we'll come back to what the justification is for doing this minimization. Okay, so we've determined that there is one change of state needed in character number one. So I'll just run a total. There's one for the first character. Here's the second character. Things get a little more complicated. Gamma and delta have ones and everybody else is a zero. Look over here, delta and gamma have ones, okay. Now, I claim that if you try to find a scenario that has only one change of state in that tree with that character, you will not succeed. Here's the smallest one. If somebody has one, let me know. Zeros all the way up, and at the last minute in the lineages to gamma and to delta, there is a change, so there are two changes. But that's not the only place that there could be two changes. You could start out with ones, change to zero here, everybody gets a one here, but at the last minute change to zero in alpha. That's another way you could have two changes. Here's a third way. Start with zero, change to one, it's inherited into delta and gamma, and then back to zero just before you get to alpha. So all those have two, require two changes. And I claim that, just by eyeball, that is the smallest possible number that you could have with that data and that phylogeny for character two. Okay, we go on to character three. Character three is ones in beta and epsilon. There is beta and epsilon. You can do it with one change here, or you can start out with a one and change back to zero there. So I claim also that, again, you should be able to just look at this and say, oh yeah, you'd need that. Please.
Are there computational or like some sort of mathematical ways to determine the minimum number of changes for a given tree and a given number of characters?
Yes, and we are going to stupefy you on that subject starting in the next lecture. We're going to give you far more detail than that than you. You will be so sorry you asked that question. Anyway, not to me. I'm happy you asked the question. Here is, and so, okay, that was the third one. That required two changes. No, one change. Sorry. Forgot what I just saw. One change. Sorry. An eraser here somewhere. Okay. One change. We get to character number four and also five. Well, four and five have the same pattern. So whatever solution we get for four is also going to work for five. Ones in alpha and, sorry, zeros in beta and gamma. Ones everywhere else. So these two are zeros, the others are ones. You can do it with two changes, one here and one there, or you could start with the other state, in which case you have two changes again back to zero in these two different lineages. Again, you will not be able to find a way to do it with only one change in this case. So we're going to get two changes there, and then we have one character left. and it has one, and everybody else is zero, and that's in delta. And the trivially obvious way of doing it all with one change is just to start out with zero, let it be inherited to everybody, and at the last minute change to one in that lineage. So, conclusion, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 changes of state. So the score for that tree is 9. And what we now imagine is, let's imagine looking at all possible trees and do this count for all of them. As we'll see, that's not practical in larger cases, but in cases like this, it is practical. And if we do that, if we go around and consider all possible trees, well, first I want to show you a summary of this tree. So this is the one we were given. And what I've done is put bars there for each character for one of the possible placements of where the changes were. So, and then number them. Those numbers are not the number of changes, they're which character the change is in. And they also are, I've colored them differently, shaded them differently to whether they're forward changes or backward changes. So character 1 changed here, character 2 changed twice in those two places for the particular choice I made. There were other possibilities. Character 3 here, character 4 in two places, 5 in two places, 6 in one place, and there are 9 bars there in all. Okay. Now suppose we change the tree a little. It happens that the most parsimonious tree is near this one. And what I'll do is change where delta is. Let's go back. Here's where we were. Watch delta. If we make it connect instead to gamma, so there's a speciation, the alpha comes off first in the speciation, then delta and gamma separate. What's going wrong here? Yeah. I'm going to have to correct a couple of those trees in the last two panels. They weren't quite right. But anyway, I did that yesterday, and it was done too quickly. Okay, here is the most parsimonious tree you can find. And it's actually very close to the tree that we had before. The tree we had before had delta coming off there from alpha. And when you reconstruct the changes of state, you go site by site, you go character by character, and you count up, you reconstruct where the changes are by eyeball, you'll get 8 of them, and there are the 8. Okay. So there are different scores for different trees, and one of them has got an 8. The others are 9 or 10 or 11. Okay, so, and we'll actually show you the whole set of them and show you the whole set of numbers of changes of states later on when we're considering searching, how you go searching for trees. Well, okay, that's a tree. Now this is a rooted tree. Everybody sort of expects trees to be rooted. They start here and then the first split is there. Time is going up. Okay, but it turns out that when you have changes of state that are going back and forth between 0 and 1, and equally penalized in either direction, then it turns out that the number of changes of state you get on a tree does not depend on where the root of the tree is, but is a property of the unrooted tree. Now, understanding the distinction between rooted and unrooted trees is part of sort of basic tree literacy. This is another tree, let me just see, yeah, with also a rooted tree with the same number of changes. It's also 8 changes. So there's more than one most parsimonious tree when you consider rooted trees. But when you start considering unrooted trees, it's like this is a tree growing in a field and you fly over it in an airplane and you take an aerial photograph of that tree. And imagine that looking down, you somehow can't see which are thick branches and which are thin branches, but you can see the branching structure of the tree. But the trunk is under one of those branches and you can't tell where it is. If that were the case, what you would see looks something like that. There's the tree viewed from the air. And here are the changes of state on that tree. And you then have to say, well, what this tells you is the way the tree is connected, but it doesn't tell you where the root is. But we could imagine that the root might be under any point on this tree, any one of these branches. And let's think about what would happen if the root were here, that under that is the main trunk of the tree. Well, then you'd say, okay, the interpretation would be that when you reach this change, you're going from state one to state zero, because what each of these changes really does is mark the boundary of a region that has state one and a region that has state zero. The changes of state are these boundaries. So if that's the case, this in character three, these guys have state one, everybody else has state zero. That means if the root were here and you go this way, you cross the boundary. And so the interpretation is that on the rooted tree, the state one is ancestral state zero. It changes to state zero once at that point. Okay. So each of these bars is a boundary of a region. And the minute you decide where to put the root, you interpret them as going in one direction or the other. But if you put the root somewhere else, for example, over here, it reinterprets all of those boundaries, but it doesn't change them. It doesn't move them at all. So the assertion I'm going to make is that the number of changes of state when parsimony allows you to go back and forth between states with equal penalty, the score of a tree does not depend on its status as a rooted tree. It depends only on what it looks like when it's an unrooted tree. And knowing how to take a tree and in your mind's eye take off the root and make it into an unrooted tree or go the other way is important, an important part of tree literacy. Okay, so another thing we can do, there is a method called outgroup rooting, which I guess I'll be ending with this. I haven't quite reached the end of today's material. If I have a tree that I've estimated, let's say from DNA data, and I have some DNA data for this, even on the website, we could make a tree, and here's the unrooted tree we would get for mouse, baboon, macaque, gibbon, orang, human, chimp, and gorilla. And then we could say, well, where's the root of that tree? Well, there's a criterion called outgroup rooting, and basically what it means in this case is to say, well, we know that all of these are primates except for the mouse. If we believe that primates are a monophyletic group, a group that has its own common ancestor, then the root was somewhere on the branch to mouse. Now, it is, in effect, saying that outgroup rooting is knowing the answer in advance. If we do that, we place the root here. Another way of thinking about outgroup rooting, and I'll end on this point, is to say, suppose I have the primates and I get an unrooted tree for them. And somebody says, well, where's the root on that? How do you know where the root is? And I say, well, I don't know, but I know that this is a monophyletic group. And I've got something else, some sequence for mouse, and I know mouse isn't in that group. Let's throw the mouse sequence in and make the unrooted most parsimonious tree, or tree in general. And we do that, and aha, the mouse connects right here, and that establishes that the flow upwards in time from the root goes this way and then branches out upwards and downwards. So outgroup rooting is partly knowing the answer in advance, or you can think of it as throwing in another species or set of species for which you know the answer in advance, that the root is going to be somewhere on the branch connecting them to the rest of the tree. And so they then probably the way to do this. Okay. I'm going to stop there. There's a couple other points that I'll make about this. And then where we're headed next time is precisely into the issue of how do you make a computer count the number of steps on a given tree. And then later, where we go from that, we talk Friday about combinatorics. How many trees are there out there? The answer is lots. And on Monday, we start into how do you search tree space? How do you, what are some of the methods for trying to find the best tree by this criteria? Okay, that's it.